Today is June 5th, year 2000. This is an interview with Ricardo Cisney. Am I saying that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay. The interviewer is Betsy Brinson, and it takes place in Mr. Cisney's hometown of Bowling Green, Kentucky. Thank you for being willing to talk with me today.
You're more than welcome.
Could we begin by you giving me your full name, your birth date, and your birthplace, please?
My name is Ricardo Cisney. I was born in Henderson, Kentucky, February 18, 1939.
Okay. And shall I call you Mr. Cisney or
Rick? Ricardo? Everybody
Rick?
Calls me
Rick. Rick. Okay. Thanks. I think I talked to you on the phone a little bit about the purpose of the project that we're doing, which is to document through oral histories the whole effort to eliminate legal segregation
Yes.
in Kentucky from 1930 to 1975. Now, I want to start, though, by going back and having you just tell me a little bit about your growing up in Henderson, your family, your education. What was life like then?
Well, I grew up in Henderson County, the city being Henderson. I went to high school at Henderson Douglas. I graduated in 1957, and of course the schools were segregated then. My memory of that time was receiving hand-me-downs, so to speak, from the other school, the quote-unquote white school that was in Henderson at the time. And we were in the band members. Of course, we had no uniforms, and we received uniforms from Henderson High School. And we were glad to get them.
And they were used uniforms.
They were used uniforms, you know, that were passed down from the main high school, which was Henderson High School, Henderson City School, to us. We were very privileged to get them. Also, this is the way we received our textbooks.
Tell me about the musical instruments. What did you play?
I played the saxophone and clarinet. And, in the band.
And where did the instruments come from?
Well, I was fortunate enough, my parents were fortunate enough to purchase my instruments from the music store.
Do you know if at the white school were the instruments provided by the school or by the families of children?
I'm not sure, but I'm under the assumption that they were provided by the school system.
Okay.
For those who who didn't have instruments of their own.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Let me take you back to your early years.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you attend elementary school?
I attended a segregated elementary school by the name of Alvis Street Elementary School.
And do you remember any of your teachers?
I remember every one of my teachers from the first grade all the way through elementary school and through high school.
Why do you think you have such a good memory of all of that?
Well, because they were very impressionable. They were concerned about their students, and they were always in hopes that all of their students achieved and excelled and went on to college, those of them that were motivated. And of course, I was motivated enough to go ahead to college on a music scholarship.
So I want to get to that in
yeah.
a few minutes. But are there any teachers in particular that you can describe to me?
Yes, there were.
Really stand out. For
there
you?
Were two of my elementary school teachers that really stood out. And that was my third grade teacher, Mrs. Florence Gardner. And my sixth grade teacher, Miss Annette C. Brown, who was the aunt of the famous actor Roscoe Lee Brown. So those two stood out. They were very concerned that I achieved, because they were very familiar with my family, and they knew that this is what my family wanted and expected. So they were very instrumental in my formative years.
Tell me about your family, or tell me about your parents, or your grandparents.
Okay.
Or
I was blessed to grow up with both parents, mm-hmm. As well as grandparents. And I'm the only child in my family. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, my mother received an 11th grade education. Mm-hmm. And my father, I think, received an 8th grade education. But he went on, and he was motivated enough to take correspondence courses. And he finished his high school through correspondence.
And where did they go to school?
Both of them attended the same school that I attended, Elvis Street. And of course, there was another school, an elementary school, 8th Street Elementary School, and that's where my father attended.
What do you know about your grandparents?
My grandfather on my mother's side received a 3rd grade education, and of course, he was motivated enough to learn on his own. And my grandmother, I don't remember just how for her education went, but she was educated. You know, all of them were readers, mm-hmm. and they were, I guess, self-motivated and self-taught.
Now, were they all from Kentucky?
Yes, all from Kentucky.
So your family's been here.
My family has been here.
Do
yes.
you have any information about how far back in Kentucky your family goes?
Only as far back as my great-grandparents. Mm-hmm. That's as far back as I can go with them. And they were from Poole, Kentucky, which is in Webster County. Mm-hmm. That's where my mother was born.
Poole,
P-O-O-L-E.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was known as Poole Town then, mm-hmm. but it's actually Poole, Kentucky in Webster County. That's where my mother's family, that's where they're from. Mm-hmm. My father's family is from Henderson.
Okay.
Yeah.
While you were growing up, Rick, how did your family make their living?
Well, my mother did domestic work. And then she also did factory work. She worked in the laundry. And she worked as a cook on a local TV show. My father was a waiter in Evansville, Indiana, which is right across the bridge. And he later became a head waiter or a maitre d'. And that's how they made their mm-hmm. money.
What sort of kind of factory did your mother work in?
Well, it wasn't so much as a factory. Well, yes, it was. Yeah, I take that back. This was, I think, during the wartime. I think she worked in a factory in Terre Haute, Indiana, mm-hmm. where they made, various appliances.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
okay.
This was part of her experience.
Okay. In growing up, were you and your family active in a church?
Yes, very active, very active. My mother was a member of the Greater North Chapel Baptist Church in Henderson, Kentucky, and my father was a member of the 7th Street Baptist Church, and I was a member of the Greater North Chapel Baptist Church.
Okay.
So we, even though we attended separate churches, we were all of the same denomination, right?
At what point do you think you became aware that you lived in a segregated society?
Funny you would ask that, because I remember when we were teenagers, a bunch of guys, we were on our bicycles. And there was a part of the town where we were not allowed to go. This was in the Audubon area of town. And we just decided one day that we would ride our bicycles out in that area of town. It was about five of us. So we got on our bikes and we rode our bikes out there, and there was a radio station out there. So we wanted to go by the radio station. And on the way back, we stopped at a little grocery store, and it was in the summertime. And we decided that we were going to go in and get a soda. So we went in, and we were served. We were served a soda, which we were very surprised. And we noticed that there were two older white fellas to come in. You know, of course they were teenagers too, but they were much older than we were. So while we were in there enjoying our sodas, one said to us, says, hey guys, says, see that dark cloud up there? And of course, you know, we didn't know exactly what he was talking about, but we looked up, you know, quite naturally we looked up. Nobody said anything. We just continued to drink our sodas. So he said, don't you think it's about time for you all to be headed back across the border? So we still didn't say anything, you know. But we got the message. So we finished our sodas, got on our bicycles. We didn't want to cause any problems, any trouble or anything. So we took off on our bicycles. But there was one of our friends with us. And he had a smart mouth. So while we were riding on, I guess we were about a block away from him. So he was the last one. He said something smart to the effect that, well, isn't it about time for your mother to get back across the border? You know, in a smart aleck way. And he went to jump on his bicycle seat, and when he did that, the chain came off. And I guess we were about two blocks down, and we just happened to look back, and they were, both of the guys were on him, you know, and they were kicking him. So, but they didn't, it didn't cause any serious damage or any serious harm or anything like that. So
did he get away, or did
yeah,
you all
they finally
go back and get?
No, we didn't go back. They finally got, you know, let him go, and he got on his bicycle. Well, he pushed his bicycle, and when he came to us, he was angry at us because we didn't go back to help him, you know. But you know, we looked at it in this light that if he hadn't said anything, if he hadn't smarted off with them, nobody would have you know, been subjected to anything like that. So we just told him, said, we didn't come out here to cause any trouble, you know. And you had no reason to say what you did. All you had to do is just get on your bike and just leave, you know. And later on, during the latter years, it became a joke. You know, we all laughed about it, you know, had a good time with that. But that was, I guess that was probably one of the most memorable experiences with that type of situation that I've had.
Okay.
Of course, at the movie theaters.
Well, let me ask you one question about that store. When you bought your sodas, were you standing up drinking them in
yes,
the store?
Yes.
There was no place to sit
no,
down.
No, no. We knew
right.
better than to
right.
try to sit down.
Okay.
Yeah, so we just stood up, you know, and we drank our sodas. But it was very surprising that we were even served,
mm-hmm.
you know, because in that part of town, you know, we knew nobody went through there.
Mm-hmm.
But in order for that part of town to get to the town area where they could, you know, down in the downtown area, they had to come through our section, so to speak. And, you know, nothing was ever done. You know, they were just free to come and go, you know, through our section of town. Nobody even thought about doing anything. But we knew better to go into that section of town, you know, because I guess, you know, they probably felt that, well, we had, you know, don't need to go through that section of town because there wasn't any downtown area down in that part of town. So they had to come through our section of town, and that's what that amounted to.
Did you graduate from the All Black High School?
Yes, I did in 1957.
All of your schooling to that point, integration had not come to Henderson.
No, not then. Not then.
Okay. What happened? You started to say something about
the movie theaters,
the movie.
Right? And that, I guess that was probably my first experience with segregation, because we were not allowed in the main part or the bottom floor of the movie theater. Of course, we had to go to the balcony. And of course, up in the balcony, it was hot, you know, and it was crowded up there, and it was very uncomfortable. You know. But that was my first, I guess, experience with segregation, that I knew that I wasn't being treated fairly. But then going through school, I never even thought about it, you know. So that's.
Henderson now, that's
right,
where
Henderson.
Tell me how large the black population was there while you were growing up.
I'd say about maybe 20 or 30%.
So
black.
A large population.
Yes, large right. population, right.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
I don't
mm-hmm.
know Henderson, but
right.
I've read
right.
a little bit about
mm-hmm.
it. And there was some trouble there, as I recall, was there not, when the schools were finally integrated?
Integrated? I don't know. I don't recall, because I was in college at the time.
Okay.
Well, no, I wasn't in college at the time. I had finished college in began teaching school here in Bowling Green when the schools became integrated, you know.
Okay. Well,
and I think this happened in 65, I believe.
They didn't call the National Guard out in Henderson?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Not
okay.
to my knowledge.
I may be thinking of the wrong place,
uh-huh.
but, and you would know, I'm sure.
Right.
Okay.
But I had a great experience when I was on the commission, because I was asked by the director if I would go to Henderson and serve on the, in the capacity of a hearing commissioner, because there were some apartments in Henderson that were trying to integrate at the time. And of course, they weren't allowed to integrate the apartments. So I had, the opportunity to go back and serve in that capacity, because there was a suit against the landlords. And I said, oh, I remember when I was a kid in this area of town when we were not allowed certain things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought that memory back to me. And I said, well, I'm in a different capacity now.
That's right.
Yeah.
What happened when you graduated from high school? What then?
Well, I graduated from high school in 57. And then I had a band scholarship to Kentucky State College at the time. It was Kentucky State University now, but it was Kentucky State College at the time. And of course, it was segregated. And I finished Kentucky State in 62. And I was employed here in the Bowling Green City School System in 1962 at a segregated school, High Street School. Right.
Now, let me ask you, what did you major in college?
I majored in biology, and I minored in French.
Okay.
And I taught general science when I finished.
Okay. Were you involved in athletics in any way while
Yes.
you were growing up?
Yes. Or? In high school, I was involved in football, basketball, and I was on the boxing team.
You could do all that and play in the band, too?
And played in the band as well. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we didn't have very many band members at the time, and a lot of the athletes played in the band. Mm-hmm. So at halftime of the football games, we would go out and perform formations, you know, with the band, because right. without us, without the athletes, the band didn't, there weren't enough members in it to form the DHS of the band.
Right. Right. Well, I myself played in my high school band, and so we played at all the athletic events, of course. And it would have been hard, you know, to have to do both. That's
Yes. So we were able to do both.
Okay. Did you do any athletics at Kentucky State?
No, I only played in the band at Kentucky State.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. It was sort of an either or at that point.
Yes, and I knew that's where my scholarship was.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I just devoted all my time to to the band.
Right. So you came to Bowling Green.
Yes.
To high school.
To High Street School.
School.
And I taught in the 7th and 8th grade.
Okay. Had you been to Bowling Green before?
Yes, because my high school played athletics against Bowling Green.
Okay.
But I had no idea that Bowling Green would ever be my home.
Mm-hmm. And it was, you saw a job announcement, or how did
no,
it
come? I just applied throughout Kentucky and throughout various other parts of, you know, of the states, mm-hmm. United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the job became available.
Mm-hmm.
Here I was contacted by the superintendent of the schools here,
mm-hmm.
that there was a job available in science if I was interested.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I was delighted. You know, I jumped at the opportunity, and I guess right after I had signed my contract with the school system here in Bowling Green, I was contacted by the school system in Peoria, Illinois. And of course, I didn't want to break my contract here, but I was thinking seriously about going to Peoria, Illinois, but I'm glad I didn't break my contract, you know, because I went on and did other things other than teach school here.
I want to ask you, because I'm aware that Bowling Green was rather late in integrating the schools, and did so as mm-hmm. a result of a court order, I believe,
yes.
in the 60s sometime.
I believe that's correct, yes.
How did that work for you? How long were you at the all-black school? And talk to me a little bit, if you would,
okay.
about that experience, and also the experience of moving over mm-hmm. into an integrated school system, okay. such as it was.
Sure. Well, I think it was in 1965 that this took place.
Mm-hmm.
We were reluctant to leave the comfort of our school. It was our comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
to go anyplace else. Fortunately, I remained at High Street because High Street became an elementary school,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the high school integrated into the city school system. So I was fortunate to remain at High Street for 6 years. Then the next 2 years I became a team leader with the National Teacher Corps
mm-hmm.
at another school. My job was to train intern teachers, you know. So I remained in that capacity for 2 years. Then I left the school system and was employed at Western Kentucky University as the assistant director to the Teacher Corps program there. And I remained there for a year. And then there was some problems in regards to, there were some racial problems at the high school, at Bowling Green High School at the time, because it was a new school. It was in 1970, I believe, when the school was built. And there were some problems with that, in the fact that when the school was built, it was put out in the community where the black students, you know, were not allowed to go, you know. So at the time, my thinking is that they were going to have two schools, and the blacks would be located in one school, and the whites would be located in another school, in one of the affluent areas of the town, of the city. And this created problems because the students that had attended High Street, they were bused into to Bowling Green High School. And of course, there were some problems then, you know. I mean, you know, they were together at the new school, and the black students just felt like they weren't wanted there. So there were some problems, you know. There were some fights to break out. You know, there were some problems with the teachers. And I was more or less recruited from Western, where I was serving in the capacity of assistant director to the Teacher Corps, to help alleviate some of the problems that they were having in the schools. So I left my job at the university and came to the city school system as assistant principal. And that was in the early part of 71, where I remained for 27 years in the capacity of assistant principal. There were jobs that became available that I had applied for the head job and never received. I think I applied about three times and didn't receive any appointments.
You know. Why do you think that might have been?
Well, the only reason that I could tell is because of my race. And I say that because I had all the qualifications and certifications of anybody else, and I had more experience than anybody else, and I was passed over. And as a matter of fact, I was told by one of the superintendents, I had there was an opening at one of the elementary schools at High Street School, High Street Elementary School. There was an opening, and
for a principal.
And I was approached, and I asked, I asked the superintendent, what if one of the positions at another school became available, you know, would I have been recruited for that school? And the superintendent told me, well, to be honest with you, no, you wouldn't be. And I said, oh, no, why? And he said, well, because I just don't think the community is ready for anything like that yet. You know? And I said, oh, okay. Thanks for telling me. But I will not accept a position at this other school, you know, at the segregated school. You know. And he said, well, you know, I mean, it's a move up. I said, it's not a move up for me. You know, it's a move back. Of course, he couldn't understand why I would pass up that opportunity.
Right.
You know.
Did High Street, as the all-black school originally, did it ever have very many white students who came to school there?
Well, there were white students there because there were several white families lived in the area of High Street. And we had some, there were white itinerant teachers, you know, who would come in and teach music, they'd come in and teach art, and we called them special teachers, you know. But yes, there were several white students.
But not many.
Not many,
right.
This is correct, not many.
And at the originally, the all-white schools, when they were integrated, were there proportionately more black students there than there were white students at the all-black school?
Yes, there were. There were more black students at the white schools.
What happened to the black teachers with integration?
Well, unfortunately, the black teachers had to assume a subservient role. They were shifted around to the various schools, but even the black teachers were sort of put back into the to the background, you know, and they were, a lot of them, the majority of them had their master's degree. They were better educated than the faculty that was already at these schools. Because the majority, as I said before, the majority of the faculty from High Street had received master's degrees and rank one degrees. Mm-hmm. You
know. And where had they gone to do graduate work at that point in time?
Well, they had gone to Indiana University, okay. I think Ohio State University, and
remember any who might have gone to Columbia Teachers College in New York City?
No, I don't remember any of them.
Not that far away?
No.
Okay. Did any of them lose their jobs? Or ask
no.
to take early retirement or sort of phased out in any way? Or?
Well, none of them actually lost their jobs, but there were a couple that were phased out. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's very unfortunate. But they were phased out.
When the it was filed to integrate the schools, what was the discussion like among the black teachers?
Well, they were concerned about how these students would be treated. They were concerned about the positions of the coaches, the head coaches, you know, mm-hmm. which none of the head coaches that were head coaches at High Street School were head coaches at Bowling Green High School. They, all of them, had to accept the position of assistant coach. When they had more experience, more years in working with students than the other coaches, but they had to come in as assistant coaches. Everyone came in as an assistant coach, which was a setback for them because they had winning teams, teams to go to the state championship, and then to be told that, well, yeah, I know you did a good job, you know, where you were, but you'll have to be the assistant coach, one of the assistant coaches, not the associate coach, but one of the assistant coaches. And of course they did, you know, they didn't have any other choice but to do that or leave.
Did they have to take pay cuts to do that?
I don't think any of the teachers had to take a cut in pay. I'm not sure, you know, but I don't think so.
Okay. Now, I know you're married now.
Yes.
So somewhere in all of this, did you fall in love and get married too?
Well, I met my bride at college, Kentucky State University. Uh-huh. She's from Albany, Georgia. Uh-huh. And she received a teaching position also at High Street. So both of us were fortunate enough to teach in the same school. Well, at first she taught at Franklin Lincoln in Franklin, Kentucky, because there wasn't a position open at the time. Then when there was a position open at High Street, then she was able to teach elementary school there. She had to go back and get another major. She majored in music, high school music in college, and there wasn't a position open for that. So she had to go back and get her certification to teach elementary school, which she did. She was taught reading. She was a special reading teacher, language arts.
Okay. Has she continued to teach, or did she?
Yes, she continued to teach. Okay. She taught on up until she retired.
Okay. Do you have any children?
I have a daughter. Okay. Yes. And she, of course, she knows nothing at all about the segregation experience.
How old is she?
She's 35 now, okay. Right? And when we tell her about how things used to be, she just can't believe. Mm-hmm. She can't believe that. She just cannot, she just can't understand why things were the way that they were, you know. And
I wonder, Rick, when the superintendent told you that you were qualified, but the time just wasn't right.
Right.
Did you think of contesting that?
I sure did. I sure did. I was thought very seriously about that. But
this would have been about what time period?
I guess maybe, say, 70. Around 70, yes, I thought seriously about contesting it, but my wife, she was unwilling for me to do so. She just didn't want the hassle, going through with that. She didn't want the publicity, and she just felt like, well, maybe something better will come along, just ride it out, of course. And I guess we're somewhat different. I wasn't willing to ride it out. I wanted to contest it, but I also wanted her to be pleased with the with the decision. Right. So
there were two of you in this,
yes,
system.
That's right. Is what she was sort of, that's why she was reluctant for me to do that.
Tell me how your appointment to the Kentucky Commission on Human Rights came about.
Well, I was very active in the community, and I was very active with the local Human Rights Commission. Mm-hmm. Through my human rights and civil rights activities in the city, I was appointed. Well, I was recommended, referred by one of the other civil rights, quote, human rights workers, because she was well known. Her name was Mrs. Lula Offutt, and she was a nurse.
Last name for me?
Offutt.
Okay.
She was a nurse at the hospital, and she was very active in civil rights. So she recommended me to the commission.
And she was a member of the local commission?
Yes, she was a member of the local commission. Okay. Right. Very active. Mm-hmm. Very active.
Tell me about that a little bit. How was she active?
Well, she was I guess she was a motivator for the citizens, in the black community, to get involved, to make themselves known, to let people know that they would be willing to serve on various boards of the city. And this was her involvement, you know. She was not a militant, a radical, you know, she was just a motivator. She wanted to see some of the people get involved. And she felt like, well, you know, if you don't let the people know that you are willing to serve, you never will receive any appointments. Mm-hmm. So, we were able to get our names around to some of the agencies and some of the advisory committees and to let people know that we would be willing to serve.
Do you know enough about her to know, did she grow up in Bowling Green or did she move here?
No, she grew up here in Bowling Green. Her family, okay. All of them were from Bowling Green, okay. Yes.
Was there a local NAACP chapter here?
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me anything about the history of it or how far back? Was it active?
Yes, it was active. It was active. There were several members with the local NAACP, and a gentleman by the name of Frank Moxley, Dr. Moxley, was very instrumental, you know, with the NAACP. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he might have been the director at the time, mm-hmm. but.
The director, or the president?
The president, yes. I'm sorry, the president, right? And he was a motivator as well. And to this day, he's still very active in the community.
I have heard about him.
Yes.
In fact,
yes,
I'm going to talk to him.
Right. And he was probably the leader during the time of the beginning, the onset of the NAACP and other organizations, you know, because everybody looked up to Mr. Moxley, you know.
So maybe he can tell me a little bit more about
the history. Oh yes, he can tell you. He knows the history of everything here in Bowling Green.
Okay.
He knows the history of Bowling Green.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you active with NAACP?
I was a member, mm-hmm. but I was more active with the Human Rights Commission.
Okay.
Right, yes,
okay.
With the local Human Rights Commission. Okay. I participated with the NAACP,
okay.
But you know, I know that I couldn't be as active as I wanted to with both of them, mm-hmm. So I chose the Human Rights
okay.
Commission.
Let me ask you, the 60s, of course, we had sit-ins and demonstrations all over mm-hmm. the South, and in Frankfort in 64, I believe it was, there was a rally
mm-hmm.
In an effort to try and get the public accommodations law mm-hmm. through the legislature. Particularly in terms of the rally in Frankfort, did anybody go from Bowling Green? Was there a contingency that went that you heard about? Or?
I really don't know. I really don't know if there was anybody from Bowling Green to go or not, but I'm almost sure that there was. I didn't go, but I believe there were several others who went.
Okay.
One thing about the integration of Bowling Green, there were no marches, there were no sit-ins, there was nothing like that, you know. Everything just sort of opened up, you know, and there really weren't any problems, you know, and it was surprising, you know. People said, you mean you all didn't have to march, you didn't have to carry any signs, you didn't have to do any of that? No, we didn't.
Why do you think that was? I mean, certainly a decade earlier,
yeah,
they dragged their feet
right,
on opening the school.
I think because the citizens of Bowling Green just really didn't want the attention, you know, brought to them. They didn't want the news media to come in. You know, they wanted everybody to feel like, well, you know, everybody's being treated fine. There's no need Lena that. And of course, my wife, she was very surprised because she's from Albany, Georgia. And that's where the civil rights movement began in Georgia, right down there. And this was during the time when Martin Luther King and all of them, you know, were down there and, you know, and marching, and there were fires every place, you know, and she just, you know, when things happened so smoothly here, you know, she couldn't understand that, you know. And I told her, I said, well, that's just the difference between Kentucky and Georgia.
It's interesting that she was from Georgia, but she came to college at Kentucky
State.
Yeah. How did that come about? Did she
There was a college that she could have attended in her own hometown, Albany State College.
Right.
But she wanted to get away from home. You know, she wanted to see what it was like in other parts of the states, mm-hmm. United States, you know. Mm-hmm. So she chose Kentucky. And I think the reason is because I think Kentucky, the Kentucky State University college at the time was cheaper, very reasonable, you know, for out-of-state students, you know. So that's why she chose to go, you know. She wanted to, she knew that she wanted to go out-of-state. So she picked a college, you know, that would be suitable for her family income.
One of the areas in this project that we're looking at is how the media, what kind of attention they did or did not give to the civil rights struggle, particularly in the 60s when there were sit-ins and demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
And as you probably know, the Louisville paper gave it a lot of coverage, mm-hmm. and some good editorial support. The Lexington paper, you may not know this, but didn't cover it at all. And there were a fair number of sit-ins and demonstrations, mm-hmm. in Lexington, mm-hmm. but they had an owner publisher who just made a very conscious decision to ignore it.
To ignore it.
And I wonder, you really didn't have that level of activity here. But my first question, Rick, would be, in the black community here in the 60s, what were the newspapers that were coming into the area that people read about what was going on in other areas? Did they watch television? How did they get news from the outside world?
Well, from newspapers, from the Courier Journal, and from the television. And of course, you know, they were, I guess some of the black citizens in Bowling Green were ready to, you know, to seize the opportunity to do some of the things that were necessary, that they felt were necessary, you know, just like some of the other cities were doing. Mm-hmm. But as I said before, they just, you know, they didn't have to do that, mm-hmm. you know. And but they were ready. They had organized various groups, you know, to I guess sit in at some of the counters, you know, at the at Woolworth, mm-hmm. and places like this, but you know, they didn't. Mm-hmm. I remember when I came to Bowling Green, you know, as I mentioned before, there was one drive-in theater that we could attend, but there was another one that we could not attend. There was one movie that we could attend, but there was another movie we couldn't attend. Mm-hmm. Bowling Alley was the same way, you know. And it just seemed like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the doors were open, you know.
How about swimming pools?
Swimming pools, there weren't any swimming pools at the time that I know about. There might have been one out at Beach Bend Park, which was a no-no. You just didn't even think about swimming.
Right.
Right.
How about the library?
The library, I don't recall about the library.
Was there a black library and a white library at one point?
No.
Oh, okay.
I guess the library that the that the black community utilized was the school's library. They were always able to come into the schools, you know, and utilize the school's library. Okay. So that's, you know.
What about the hospital and health care? Were there any black physicians in town?
Yes, or? Yes, there were. There was, as a matter of fact, there were, I guess, two or three medical doctors, black medical doctors at the time, and that was Dr. Z.K. Jones and Dr. Beckett. They were physicians at the time, and they were able to go, you know, from their office to the hospital, you know. And let's see,
So they had hospital privileges?
Hospital privileges, yes. There were, I think there was a dentist here, there was a pharmacist, but only the two doctors, you know, remained. I think the others passed away, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, all of them, you know, passed away now.
Right. Are there any black physicians today?
I think there's one.
Okay.
I think there's one.
How about lawyers?
Lawyers? No. No lawyers. Only one black doctor. Dentist? No. One black dentist. I'm sorry. Female. No pharmacists.
Okay. Are there any prominent black businessmen or women in the community?
Yes, there's a car dealership, mm-hmm. Martin, okay. Cornelius Martin, you know, who has a Cadillac dealership here.
Okay.
And of course, there is a plant manager to the General Motors Corvette Assembly mm-hmm. plant is black. That's just about it.
Okay. Is the black population today about the same percent of the total population that it was, say, when you first arrived here? Or have many blacks left and gone elsewhere?
Well, I think there's more now because of the Corvette assembly plant.
Mm-hmm.
You have so many of the white population has grown mm-hmm. tremendously. You know.
When you say the plant, you mean because it has opened up jobs to?
Well, they brought in the employers that they had at the General Motors plant in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of St. Louis people to come to mm-hmm. Bowling Green.
Okay, I didn't ask that question right, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. People who grew up here,
mm-hmm.
In the black community, do they tend to stay because they can find work, they can find community?
Yes, the people.
Or do they leave?
Oh, no, the people who grew up in Bowling Green and their children remain in Bowling Green. But we have several people to come into Bowling Green
mm-hmm.
and then leave and go to other places. Mm-hmm. But the people that were born here, the generations, yeah, they have remained in Bowling Green. They just, you know, they won't leave. They just.
What about sons and daughters when they graduate high school and go off to college? Do they come back, or do they tend to go other places?
Some of them come back, and a lot of them attend Western Kentucky University. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, they are able to stay at home and get, mm-hmm. you know, pretty decent jobs.
Mm-hmm.
There are several who leave, but I guess the home people sort of stay.
Mm-hmm.
They stay around.
Okay. Let me go back to your early involvement mm-hmm. with the local commission on human rights. Talk to me about that. How did you get interested, and what were you doing with them?
Well, I was.
What was happening with the commission at that point?
Well, I was young and energetic, and I saw some things that needed to be done, mm-hmm. and there were other young, energetic people around. And we were just not satisfied sitting back, letting things go the way they were. We wanted to get involved. We wanted to make sure that the youth had something to look forward to, you know. We weren't as concerned about ourselves as we were about the youth, the children coming up. And that's how I got involved, because I was asked to coach one of the Little League baseball teams. Mm-hmm. Well, this was the Jackie Robinson League, you know. So I said, well, you know, these kids, our kids, have so much talent, but we're not allowed to play any other teams, you know, in the community. We have to play the teams in our league, you know. And I didn't think that was fair, because we
couldn't. Were they all black teams?
Yes, they were all black teams of the Jackie Robinson League, you know, where you had other leagues in the city, you know, that we weren't allowed to play, you know. They weren't allowed to play. Well, we would have allowed them to play us, but they didn't want to play us, you know. But we weren't allowed to play them, so we had our own league. And I knew to, you know, in order for our kids to get recognized, you know, their talents to get recognized, there had to be something. There had to be some exposure, mm-hmm. you know. And that's one of the reasons why I became as active with the commission as I did.
Do you remember?
And for employment purposes as well. I wanted to make sure that a lot of the people in the community, especially those that grew up in the community of Bowling Green, were allowed
right.
to get right. decent jobs.
Right.
Because
did the early commission here actually handle complaints? Or was it, in some places, early commissions tended to study, to make recommendations, to advocate that way? But they didn't at first,
the
nor
early,
did the state commission
right.
either.
The early commission, no, they're more or less acted in the capacity of the NAACP, mm-hmm. you know. They heard complaints, mm-hmm. and they tried to do what they could about the complaints. They would go in and they would talk mm-hmm. to landlords, plant managers, and this type of thing, but to really be that effective, mm-hmm. no, they didn't receive complaints, you know, as like the commission does now. You know, we've got the Human Rights Commission now receive complaints, and they're able to do something about it. You know.
Mm-hmm. And the Bowling Green Commission still exists today.
Right, yes, yes.
Oh, good.
Yes.
In some places that's
right.
not true. But,
mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell me about your appointment to the State Commission. How did that come about?
Well, that's what I was referring to when I was talking about Lula Offutt.
Right.
She was the one who referred me to the state, you know. And I guess she saw something in me at the time, you know. She saw how active and how involved I was, and she said, wow, you know, maybe he needs to go on further, you know, because he has some ideas, you know, that maybe he could sort of, you know, help us with. So she recommended to the governor, you know, that I would be appointed, and that's how my appointment came about.
Do you remember any of the meetings? What were they like? Were they Louisville always, or did they move around the state?
No, at the time they were just in Louisville, right?
Okay.
And they were very, the commission was very effective. And they were, you know, I was very impressed with it, you know. I said, wow, I didn't know all this was going on, you know. And the little things that we were involved with in Bowling Green, you know, when I got to the state commission, I saw so many, you know, major problems, you know, and I felt good about being a part of that, you know.
Do you remember any of the other individuals who served with you or
on
the staff at the time?
Yes.
I guess Galen Martin was.
Galen Martin was one.
Right.
I mean, very, very active, very upfront, very for real. I called him a for real guy. You know, he was, and the other staff members were, you know, it was Tom Ebendorf, I remember, you know, who was very, he was a very good staff member.
Was there he was, a lawyer?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And there was Lakeland Cosby, you know, who was he was on the staff. And
Cosby, like Bill Cosby?
Yes.
C-O-S-B-Y.
Yes. Yes.
No relation.
No relation. He'd probably say that he was. Yeah. Yeah. And let's see.
The other commissioners? Or?
Yes, there was Dr. Lashley from Hopkinsville. He served on the commission at the time. And
tell me about him, because I'm actually going to interview him in
July.
I don't
think you will.
Well, he now lives in Skokie, Illinois, and he's in a nursing home.
I thought he had passed on.
No, I talked to his daughter just a couple weeks ago.
Dr. Lashley from Hopkinsville?
Mm-hmm.
I was told that he had passed on. Okay.
He was at the Virginia Street
That's
Baptist
correct.
Church.
That's correct.
No, he's still living.
Oh, okay.
If you want, I'll give you his address. I'll send it to you.
No, okay, I would appreciate it.
Okay.
I would appreciate it. Because he and I traveled to Atlanta for the National Convention, the Human Rights Convention. Yeah, we went together for that.
And he is in a nursing home, but his daughter says he's quite, you know, his
alert.
Mind is
his
quite alert and whatnot.
And well, I wasn't aware of that. So. I'm glad.
Right. Okay.
I'm glad to know that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about him. And you went to the Atlanta conference.
Yes. Dr. Lashley was very respected in the community of Hopkinsville because he was a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also, I think he served in the school system there, I believe. I'm not sure. But he was very active in civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's how his appointment came about, because of his being as active as he was at the time.
That's right. I see you both were appointed in 1971.
Okay.
The same
same
okay. time. You served much longer
yes.
than he did. He was there about 5 years.
Right, I had three appointments. I was reappointed because I served as a hearing commissioner, you know, across the state, you know. And I guess that's why I stayed on as long as I did, you know, because they would call me and say, hey, we've got a case in Owensboro, you know. We need you to go down there to serve as a hearing commissioner down there, you know. So I'd go down there and I'd go various parts of the state, you know.
Mm-hmm. And, do you remember any of those cases that sort of stand out in your recollection of that experience?
Yes, I do. And they were dealing with housing situations, you know. And I remember.
I'm going to stop just a minute and turn the tape over.
The case I remember most dealt with apartments here, right here in Bowling Green. And of course, there were lawyers from Bowling Green that I had to deal with as a hearing commissioner. And they were, you know, they knew me in the city as being a school teacher, but they didn't know at the time that I was on the state commissioner. So when they saw me there, you know, they were wondering, you know, like, what is this guy doing, you know, behind the bench? And I remember that those cases quite well. But most of them dealt with housing, the ones that I served on.
I don't know. I haven't asked anybody this, Rick, from the commission, but did you receive any sort of stipend for your work with them? Did they reimburse your travel or your meals? I mean, was there anything to kind of offset your expenses?
Yes, there was a stipend that we received. I can't remember how much it was. But we would receive a stipend for our gas and for our food, okay. You know, this type of thing,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How about any other people that you recall who served with you?
Yes, there was a gentleman from Franklin by the name of Jimmy Stewart.
What can you tell me about him? Was he a teacher also?
Yes, he taught in the Franklin Simpson County school system. He taught at the high school there in Franklin, Franklin Simpson. I taught social studies, and that's about the only thing I could tell you about him. I think he served one term, I believe.
Okay. You know. The commission today thinks that he may have moved to Louisville.
Yes, he's in Louisville. That's correct. Okay. Yes, yes.
But we haven't been able to locate him.
I haven't been able to locate him either. I've been trying to locate him. I haven't been able to locate him either. You know.
Okay. There was also a gentleman named Grant Wilson from Somerset. Was there from 71 to 75.
Mm-hmm.
He's deceased.
Right.
Do you know anything about him?
No,
do
I don't know.
Him?
I remember him, but I don't know anything about him.
Okay.
And there was a gentleman from Eddyville or Katoy or someplace in western Kentucky. No, there's a gentleman from Madisonville, Caldwell Smith, who has passed on.
No, I don't have anything about him.
About Caldwell Smith?
No. Thank you. I'll write that down. Caldwell?
Right. Caldwell Smith. He's passed on now.
And he was from Madisonville?
Madisonville, okay. Right.
Was he white or black?
He's black.
Okay.
And let's see.
Do you remember anything about what he did?
He was the vice principal of the school,
okay.
One of the schools in Madisonville.
Okay. And then the gentleman that you were referring to from Kudawa, is it Ewing Benberry?
That's it. Mr. Benberry.
Okay.
Mr. Benberry, yes.
What do you remember about him?
Well, soft-spoken, very alert, very intelligent, very concerned about the problems that were going on in the state.
Mm-hmm. Was he a hearing examiner with you that you remember?
No, no.
Okay.
No. I was the, I did most of the, I heard most of the cases, you know, I was the hearing commissioner for the majority of the cases.
Okay. did you, when you were the hearing examiner, was your territory by and large in this area of the state?
Or yes.
They would never send you, say, to Ashland or?
No, we went to Ashland for one of our meetings.
Right.
Right. And that's, but as far as being a hearing commissioner at those places, no, it's just around in this area, Owensboro, Henderson, Bowling Green. I think these were the only places that I can remember.
Reverend James Crumlin.
Crumlin, yeah, that's right. I forgot about Mr. Crumlin, yes.
And
yes.
He was on the commission.
Yes. Jim Crumlin is exactly right.
Right. And as I understand it, he was also one of the attorneys that helped to bring the lawsuit here to integrate the school.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Sure did.
Have you had any contact with him in a while?
No, I sure haven't. Don't know where he is.
Well, he's in Louisville.
Oh, he's still in Louisville?
He's had a stroke.
Oh, he has. Okay.
And it's a little hard to understand him.
Okay.
At this point
all right.
in time, but he's still,
okay.
still active.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you also about a gentleman from Lexington named Paul Oberst.
Paul Oberst. I was trying to remember Mr. Oberst's name. Yes, Paul Oberst. Is he still around?
He still is.
Is he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's not in good health.
Okay.
But was he on the commission during
yes.
the time that
yes, he was.
Were?
Yes, he was. Right.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I believe he was the chairman of the commission at that time.
That's right. That mm-hmm. would have been. Okay. And then I have a Mrs. Bell Smith. Was on from 69 to 75.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I don't know anything about her, where she was
from. I don't know anything about
okay.
her either.
And the Fred Ann House from 71.
I remember Fred, yes, I do.
Do you remember where he was from?
No. I thought he was from Louisville, but he's on that picture with me that was taken here in Bowling Green. Fred Ann House,
okay.
he sure was. I remember that.
And then there was a Fanny Rosenbaum, a white woman from Louisville.
Fanny Rosenbaum.
Who was on mm-hmm. during that time,
right.
Jewish.
Yes, I remember Ms. Rosenbaum, right.
What, do you have any recollection of her?
Not anything that would stand out,
okay.
you know. She was fiery, I remember that.
Was she?
She
okay.
was fiery, yes.
Okay. About a Vernon Lee Johnson.
Vernon Lee Johnson, yes, I remember him.
Where, do you remember where he was from?
No. As a matter of fact, I didn't remember his last name until you mentioned, I remembered Vernon, but I didn't remember his last name. I don't know where Vernon was from.
About a Dr. C.L. Finch.
Dr. Finch, I don't remember Dr. Finch.
Okay. And a gentleman named Grant Wilson was having an appointment from 1971 to 75.
Grant Wilson, I'm sure I've forgotten him. I've forgotten him.
Let me see here. Trouble
locating some of these people.
Okay. Well, anything else that you want to share about that Kentucky Commission on Human Rights experience?
Well, it was probably the most rewarding experience that I have had since I've been in Bowling Green. There was a lot of good that it did. It it was just needed, and it served the purpose of the need. And I can't say enough good things about Galen as a director. You know, Galen was on top of everything, you know, and he would share everything with us. You know, there wasn't anything that would come through his office that he wouldn't let us know about. And he was willing to send anybody out to various areas that there were complaints, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was just a concerned person, you know. And I think Galen would have served in that capacity if he wasn't even paid, you know. Mm-hmm. He was really into what he was doing. And I really admired him for that, as well as everybody else admired Galen for that. You know? And I wish him well, whatever he's doing now.
Well, he's supposed to be, like you, retired, mm-hmm, but he's not. Mm-hmm. He's working for, well, I don't know if he's even working. He works with one of the housing coalitions. But okay. Right now, he's very involved in the school desegregation suit that has been brought in the last year. Okay. And he's following it very closely. And
well, go Galen. Right. I knew he would be involved. What about Tom Ebendorf? Do you know anything about Tom Ebendorf?
I don't. The other thing I'll tell you about Galen is he's a beekeeper.
Oh, is he?
And I don't know if he's always been a beekeeper, but
that's first to my knowledge.
I interviewed him, and we did a couple of sessions together in Louisville last September, and I know he called me one day and he said, "We have to change this. My bees have come in and I've got to put my honey up, you know."
Is that right?
And so he's nice enough to bring me a jar of his honey.
How about that? But, how about that?
I think he does that as a hobby, though.
Yeah. You know, Galen was always in my corner, you know. Mm-hmm. When I didn't receive the appointments, you know, or recommendations for the job openings at the high schools for head principal, you know, Galen was always right there, supportive, you know, wanting me to go ahead and file a complaint, you know. And he was just concerned. I remember when the school system was having its problems, you know, Galen would send down people from the State Department to investigate what was going on, you know, and talk with various teachers, talk with students and everything, you know. And that's one of the reasons why things were went as smooth as they did, because Galen was on top of things. A lot of times he wouldn't even wait until, you know, a formal complaint was filed. You know, he would try to get somebody to initiate, you know, a complaint. You know, and I really admired him for that.
You told me before we turned the tape recorder on, I believe, that you had retired from the school system,
right,
2 years ago.
Yes, yes.
And that you're now working at Western University.
That's correct.
And tell me again what your role is there.
I work as academic advisor for athletics. Okay. And I work primarily with the golf team, the women's and men's golf team, mm-hmm, and the football team. Mm-hmm. And I work 12 hours a week. And my job is to make sure that the athletes keep their grades up, mm-hmm, so that they can maintain their scholarship and their eligibility.
You know. Yeah, and important job.
It's a very rewarding job, and it can be frustrating at times, because a lot of times the athletes, you know, they have been used to being passed along in high school. A lot of them come to college with that same mentality, mm-hmm, and I have to let them know that they're in the major leagues now, not in the minor league, and they're going to have to study. So whenever I check with the professors to see that, you know, they're not doing as well as they should, then I refer them to the tutoring coordinator,
mm-hmm.
you know, or to the study hall, and make sure that they're there doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part-time job, but it's full-time responsibility.
It sounds like, though, you're, in a way, you're continuing to do what you've done in your teaching principal
role. Yes, that's exactly.
You're still mentoring, helping,
yes.
counseling young
that's
people.
That's exactly what, and I hope to do that for the duration, you know, as long as I can, because that's what I enjoy doing, and I was very blessed to get that position at Western, you know. And I guess probably the main reason I got it is because of my involvement in the high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always tried to be fair with all the students, you know, and firm but fair,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I make sure that there were human relations programs
right.
going on there, you know, and that all the kids mm-hmm. got a fair chance, you know, and we organized different groups. We organized student union groups, and we opened up the student union groups to everybody, to all the students. We had cultural diversity groups, you know, whereas we had several. During the time, there were what to call the hippie generation, you know,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the hippie kids wanted to be to themselves because they were an outcast at the school, you know, and they wanted to organize, but they couldn't get anybody to serve as an advisor. None of the faculty members were serving as an advisor, so I ended up serving as their advisor, you know. So we had a good time with that. We'd go out and we'd do good things for the community. I had a big afro at the time. I had a huge afro at the time, you know. And I just enjoyed my career in the schools. Yeah.
That's great. Is your wife retired too?
Yes, she retired, and she's doing substitute teaching now.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. She can't get out of it. She's in love with it, and she can't get away from it.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add to what we've talked about tonight?
I just wish that the commission would still continue on, and I'm sure that it will, because there will always be problems. There will always be problems, always complaints, and I just hope that the commission remains as active in the future as it has in the past, and wish that everybody could have experience serving and working with Galen Martin.
And hopefully you'll come to Louisville to the July 18th.
I'm going to try to make every effort I can to be there.
Well, good.
Yes.
Well, good.
Yes.
Well, thank you
yes.
very much for talking with me.
Well, you're more than welcome. You're more than welcome.